Blog Talk Radio.
Fucking food, the ramen noodle. This simple voodoo is so maniacal, reliable to pull a juju. The irony is that this bad bitch in my lap, she don't tell me she make money, she don't study that. She gon' give it to me, ain't gon' tell me running back. She gon' take the brain away the plane, she spit on that. Vidor's a sign with it, don't try to rhyme with it. VH1 has a show that you can waste the time with. Guilty pleasure takes the edge off reality, and for a salary, I'll probably do that just sporadically. The OG Gucci boots are smitten with iguanas. The IRS. In the hood, living in a fishbowl. Gentrify here, now it's not a shithole. Trendsetter, I know my shit's cold. Hand set of it because I ain't so bold. But yeah, all you black folks, you must go. All you Mexicans, you must go. And all you poor folks, you must go. Boy, we hate your ways. All you bad folks, you must go.
The fog and the smog of the media, the lost false narratives of gods that came up against the odds. We're not just nigger rappers with the bars. It's kismet that we're conflict with the stars. You bastards overlooking street art, better yet street smart, but you keep us off the charts. Some of the fuck your numbers and your statistician. Fuck y'all know about true competition. It's like the AO picture on there talking about he hitting. The only one who's hitting are the ones that's currently spitting. We got your Missy smitten, rubbing on a little kitten, dreaming of a world that's equal for women with no division. Boy, I tell you that's vision. Like Tony Romo when he hitting, witting. To try and be the best in a division. Shaheed Muhammad cut it with precision. Who can come back years later, still hit the shot? Still, I'm trying to move you off the fucking block. Babylon, blood clot. Troop on your head, Todd.
All you black folks, you must go. All you Mexicans, you must go. And all you poor folks, you must go. Muslims and gays, boy, we hate your ways. All you bad folks, you must go.
All right, welcome to the show. I'm seeing that light on here. Hey, welcome to the show. I'm here. I'm late, but I'm here. Seems like the entire Raleigh-Durham metro area is surrounded by accidents. People are trying to get out of town, and the traffic is really, really bad. So I apologize for being a few minutes late, but I'm here. The show must go on. Welcome to the show, November 22, 2016, 8:12 on the East Coast. Tonight is going to be an educational show. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. This is the Aunt Canary Experience. I am your host, Aunt Canary. Thank you for being with me. Like I said, tonight's topic is the truth about Thanksgiving remix. Last year I did a show similar to this last year about the real meaning of Thanksgiving. If you listened to that show, I'm glad you did. This is pretty much the same show as last year. I think I've added a few more clips, a few more things, so this is going to be educational tonight, so you don't have to call in. All you have to do is listen, and hopefully you will learn something tonight. Maybe you'll learn something about Thanksgiving you didn't know, which is fine, and maybe you already know about some things, and hopefully I'll add on to your knowledge. So this is going to be a show tonight full of clips and information, so you don't have to call in. Like I said, all you have to do is listen. Sit back and gain a little bit of knowledge, because knowledge is not a bad thing. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play the commercial, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about a new segment that I'm going to introduce this week, and it's going to keep on going, and I'll explain it to you in just a second. I'm going to do that, and then we're going to jump right into the clips about Thanksgiving. So this is going to be a show with all clips, information, more information I can tell you. That's why I like using the clips, because they can do the job that I can't do, because lots of times it's better to hear these things with the, you know, music, sound effects, stuff like that, and then me just sitting here reading everything to you. So tonight, again, the topic, the truth about Thanksgiving remix. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play the ad, and then I'm going to jump in to the newest segment of the show, and then we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
The Initiative Radio Network mission is the challenge facing all of us is to rise above the things that have kept us divided in the past by focusing on the agenda of creating a better future for our people, to see how all of us, with all of our varied differences, can come together and direct our energy, not at each other, but at the condition of the reality of the suffering of our people, that we may use all of our skills, gifts, and talents to create a better world for ourselves, our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. It is time for us to stop thinking and acting solely on behalf of our churches, mosques, temples, synagogues, and organizations. It is time for us as leaders to come together and begin to think, plan, and act on the whole of our people. We must put an end to the mischief and the mischief maker.
Okay, that was the mission of the Initiative Radio Network. I'm sorry, I'm getting over a cold, so you may hear me coughing every now and again. But it's all good. Like I said, that was a clip telling you about the mission statement behind the Initiative Radio Network. And this is a great network. I'm glad to be a part of it. You know, we try to give out information. We try to get you to learn things that you may not know. And that's what it's all about. And tonight, this is an example of trying to give you information that you need. I'm not going to give the call-in number because you won't need it tonight. And I think our number has changed, so if it does change, I will be sure to get that number to you so you can continue to call in. But like I said, you won't need to call in tonight. All you need to do is listen and learn, take you back to school, give you some knowledge because, like I said, Thursday is Thanksgiving Day. And for some people, you know, they may not know the real deal behind that. So I'm going to get into it and drop that science on you. So I'm going to do that in just a second. But before I do that, this new segment that I'm getting ready to introduce, as you know, last week, in my opinion, we didn't have much of a choice to replace President Barack Obama. So we had to choose between the lesser of two evils, and we got the most evil part of the deal. So he is their president. He's not my president. I didn't vote for him. So I've made a vow until I see otherwise that for the next 4 years, he hadn't been sworn in yet, but for the next 4 years, I'm going to be all over this guy like a cheap suit. So from here on out on my show, before I get started, I'm going to have a segment on something he said, something he did, something he didn't do, or whatever. And I'm going to be doing this until he's out of office, hopefully in 4 years. What I'm going to do right now, I'm going to play you a clip, a snippet, and then I'm going to play a clip. But as you all, you may know, if you're, you know your history, you may know that the president has his own, like a theme song, which is called Hail to the Chief. You know, dun, 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 dun. I don't have it, so I can't play it. Dun, 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 dun. You know it. You've heard it. But in my opinion, Trump doesn't get that theme, that music, and I'm going to call him Trump. I'm not calling him President Trump because he's not my president. But Trump doesn't get his own thing. He doesn't get to use Hail to the Chief. He gets to use this. Concerned, he doesn't deserve to get the Hail to the Chief. So that's his song. So every time you hear me play that song, that means that I am about to tell you something about this knucklehead. So that's what I'm getting ready to do right now. And this is a clip. Oh, let me go back. All during the you may have noticed today on the news that a lot of the promises he made while he was campaigning, he's falling back on a bunch of them. There's too many to mention right now, but the one promise that he did make that I want to jump on tonight before we get into the Thanksgiving segment is he talked about the wall, and this is a segment showing that, in my opinion, the wall ain't getting built, and they're going to tell you why.
Donald Trump trounced his opponents on Super Tuesday. That means some of his existing policy ideas are getting closer and closer to a reality test, and one of the most controversial ones is his proposal to build a colossal wall along the United States-Mexico border. In last week's CNN debate, he told voters how he would get it done.
Now, the wall is $10 billion to $12 billion if I do it. If these guys do it, it'll end up costing $200 billion. You need 1,000 miles, and it's a real wall. This is a wall that's a heck of a lot higher than the ceiling you're looking at. This is a wall that's going to work.
But here's a closer look at what Trump's wall would entail. First of all, the current wall spans the entire length of the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border, mostly in fragments. It consists of about a dozen different types of barriers, from vehicle barriers to pedestrian fencing. The U.S. has already built about 700 miles of the wall as a result of the 2006 Secure Fencing Act. Most of it's in California, Arizona, and New Mexico. Trump wants at least 1,000 miles of wall along the border, particularly in Texas. The highest the current wall gets is a mere 18 feet, which is nothing compared to the 30-foot wall Trump proposed last year in August, or the 50-foot one he later amended in October, or the 35-foot one from February, or the 41-foot one a little later in the month, or the 45-foot one from a few days after that, or the most recent figure, 55 feet. As for the wall's material, Trump wants to use precast planks of concrete like you see along some highways. He wants the wall to have a big, beautiful door that would only let in good immigrants while keeping bad ones out. In the end, the massive project could require twice the amount of concrete as the Hoover Dam. But Trump's wall would run into complications here, especially along the Texas border, where the Rio Grande River demarcates United States territory from Mexico. 65% of the border is in Texas, but Texas currently only has 150 miles of barriers. And that's because Congress has run into a number of complications there. First of all, U.S.-Mexico treaties prevent either side from building anything within the Rio Grande's floodplains. That means the U.S. has to build fencing primarily on the private property of Texans, especially ranchers, who don't generally want to sell their land to the federal government. The issue of eminent domain in Texas, or land condemnation, where the government sues or compensates individuals for permission to build in their backyards, adds a tremendous cost to Trump's project. While some engineers have pinned the cost of Trump's wall at $25 billion, $15 billion more than he's proposed, land condemnation could drive the price tag up even higher.
Okay. That's your weekly Trump diss. And I'll be doing that, like I said, from here on out until I see anything different otherwise. So that's just the new segment I'm introducing tonight. So what I want to do now, go ahead and jump into this lesson on Thanksgiving. Like I said, it's going to be tonight. It's going to be educational. You don't need to call in. There's going to be clip after clip after clip, so you may hear pause in between clips. But this is just to give you information on the meaning of the holiday, the truthful meaning about the holiday. Because in schools, what teachers, and it's not their fault, but what curriculums like to do is pretend that the Native Americans and the Pilgrims are friendly, they had dinner together, blah, 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 but there's a whole lot more to it than that. So we're going to get into that right now. And before I go, you may hear my voice at the end of the show. I may come out and tell you good night or whatever. But in case I don't, I just want to wish everybody out there, all my fans, callers, friends, you know who you are, safe holiday weekend. Like I said, already in Raleigh, people are trying to get out of town and traffic is jack. I have to work the rest of the week, so I got how that goes. But hopefully I'll be able to get to Mom's house for some turkey and sweet potato pie. And I'm really looking forward to that. So I just want to wish all of you a very safe and happy holiday. See you back next year. You will hear from me again next Tuesday night on another interesting topic. But until then, enjoy yourselves. hopefully you can listen to this while you're cooking or whatever it is you're doing. And I hope you enjoy this tonight. It's full of great information. Some of it's controversial, but that's the way it is. That's why I like to keep it here at the show. You know, I'd rather tell you the truth than sit here and lie to you and, you know, give you just misinformation. So here we go. Enjoy. See you next week.
Pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us.
Plymouth Rock is an important symbol to Americans because it is taught in the American educational system that the supposed founding fathers of America, the Pilgrims, landed on a rock on the shore of Plymouth Harbor in Plymouth, Massachusetts is false. There are no contemporary references to the Pilgrims landing on a rock at Plymouth. There are two primary sources written by pilgrims themselves describing the land in Plymouth in 1620. The first book is William Bradford's Journal of Plymouth Plantation and the 1622 book Mort's Relation. Both simply state that the pilgrims landed, neither mentions any rocks in their account of the landing. The first references to Plymouth Rock are found over 100 years after the pilgrims actually landed. The story began in 1614 when a band of English explorers under Captain John Smith, better known for having been rescued by Pocahontas at the Jamestown colony several years earlier, and some other ships under his command arrived to map Cape Cod and vicinity was completed and sailed home to England with a ship full of Patuxet Indians and Nauset Indians bound for slavery. The Nauset and Patuxet tribes were outraged by the kidnappings and became extremely hostile. English and French ships visiting Plymouth and Cape Cod were no longer welcomed with profitable beaver trade as an unwitting French captain and crew would discover in 1617 when their ship was burned and almost everyone, a few were enslaved by the Nauset. The explorers left behind smallpox, which virtually wiped out the entire village at Patuxent and those who had escaped. The Pilgrims originally left England in 1608 and went to Holland. The Pilgrims were dissatisfied with the lack of religious freedom. At the time the Pilgrims were living in England, there was only one church approved by the English rulers. Everyone was required to attend that church and only that church every week. If the English ruler were Protestant, all people of the realm were required to follow Protestant beliefs and attend those church services. If the ruler were Catholic, everyone in the kingdom was required to practice the Catholic faith and rituals. All religion in the kingdom was strictly dictated by the government. This is what we call a state church. The reigning ruler appointed the archbishop of his or her choice, and every church in the kingdom was under the direct orders of the ruler and the archbishop. There was no freedom to choose what a person believed or how he could worship. The Pilgrims had petitioned the king to allow them to form their own church, which the king denied the Pilgrims' request. The Pilgrims left England in 1608 for Holland due to overpopulation, which brought demands and competition for land, food, and also increased hunger, plagues, diseases such as smallpox was rampant, and death. European cities grew more rapidly before and throughout the 16th and 17th century. Discussions on the advantages and disadvantages of population growth were frequent. Richard Hakluyt, an English writer, observed that, "Through our long peace and seldom sickness, we are grown more populous than ever heretofore. Many thousands of idle persons are within this realm, which having no way to be set on work, be either mutinous and seek alteration in the state, or at least very burdensome to the commonwealth." Jean Bodin, a French jurist and political philosopher, argued that a larger population would mean more production and in turn more export, which would increase the influx of silver and gold, and thus increase the riches of a country. Giovanni Botero, an Italian priest and diplomat, emphasized that the greatness of a city rests on the multitude of its inhabitants and their power, but pointed out that a population cannot increase beyond its food supply. If this limit was approached, late marriage, immigration, and war would serve to restore the balance. Martin Luther, a German monk and theologian, concluded on the issue, "God makes children. He is also going to feed them." Although the Pilgrims found religious freedom in Holland, the decision to leave Holland was based on a number of considerations. In the early 17th century, Holland was overpopulated in relation to the economic situation of the day, much like England. William Bradford, Pilgrim, founder, long-term governor of Plymouth County, and author of Plymouth Plantation, spoke of the hardness of the place and country. The only occupations available to English immigrants were those in low-paying jobs such as cloth making, related trades, and other labor-intensive occupations. Some of the English who had fled to Holland expended their funds and returned to the prisons of England rather than endure the hardships in Holland. Many of those who remained in Holland began to succumb under the hardships and from old age. Bradford tells us, "Their great and continual labors with other crosses and sorrows hastened it death before its time." In many instances, the children were forced to labor alongside their parents in order to survive. As Bradford put it, "Their bodies bowed under the weight of the same and became decrepit in their youth, the vigor of nature being consumed in the very bud, as it were." Some of the young men became soldiers in the Dutch military, and others took to the sea for livelihood, life situations which tended to lead them into dissolutions and the danger of their souls. The Pilgrim Fathers saw their posterity would be in danger to degenerate and be corrupted. It appeared to the English community that the Dutch did not remember the Lord's Day and keep it holy, but after Sunday church services allowed feasting and merrymaking, especially among the children. This was intolerable to the English. The younger family members were beginning to lose their English identity and become more Dutch than English. The Pilgrims wanted to go to the New World, as they knew the land and food was abundant, and few indigenous inhabitants were in the new land compared to England and Holland. The Pilgrims wanted to keep their religion and English intact, English lineage intact. On September 6, 1620, the Pilgrims left Holland and moved back to England and prepared to leave for the New World on a ship. The ship was called the Speedwell. The Speedwell sailed to Plymouth, England to join up with the Mayflower. However, the Speedwell began to leak so badly that it returned to England and its 102 passengers continued aboard the Mayflower. On September 6, 1620, the Pilgrims had set sail for the New World from Plymouth, England, on a ship called the Mayflower. The ship's master, Christopher Jones, is an experienced skipper, but the two-month journey will not be a smooth one. The journey was an arduous, difficult one because of a violent autumn storm, which had blown the ship off course. When the Pilgrims crossed the Atlantic Ocean, they were destined for the rocky shores of the Virginia area, but in error landed on the Cape Cod area of New England. The Pilgrims could not continue on to Virginia due to the approach of bad weather and winter storms. Contrary to popular belief, the Mayflower did not land at Plymouth Rock. It landed at the tip of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, on November 11, 1620, after 65 days at sea to establish Plymouth Colony. But one fact that is always hidden is that the village was already named Patuxet, and the Wampanoag Indians lived there for thousands of years with a sophisticated technology and civilization. After 65 days at sea, the Pilgrims remained on the ship the following day, as it was a Sunday for prayer and worship. The pilgrims assembled a small boat and actually set foot on land November 13, 1620. In the boat, they made three expeditions over the next few weeks exploring the coastline. Only around half of the 120-plus passengers on the Mayflower survived, mostly because of diseases contracted on the voyage. We can only guess what the Wampanoags must have thought when they first saw the strange ships of the pilgrims arriving on their shores. But their custom was to help visitors, and they treated the newcomers with courtesy. It was mainly because of their kindness that the pilgrims survived at all. The wheat the pilgrims had brought with them to plant would not grow in the rocky soil. The Wampanoags had six yearly harvest festivals. The Maple Dance, thanking the Creator for maple trees and their syrup, was the beginning of their new year. Next was the Planting Feast, when seeds were blessed, followed by the Strawberry Festival, celebrating the first fruits of the season. Summer's Green Corn Festival gave thanks for ripening corn, and late fall's Harvest Festival gave thanks for the harvested crops, which coincides with the Hebrew biblical customs. There's a dearth of information about the Midwinter Festival, the last one of the old year. Squanto, a member of the Pocono Wampanoag Nation, was from Patuxent. In 1605, he traveled to England with English explorer John Weymouth, where he learned the language of English. After he returned to New England, Squanto was captured by a British slave owner and sold to Spaniards in the Caribbean islands. A Franciscan priest helped him get to England via Spain. Squanto found Weymouth, who paid his way home. While in England, Squanto met Samoset, Wabanaki tribe member, who also left England with an English explorer. They returned to Patuxent in 1620. When they arrived, they found a deserted village and skeletons of those who had died from smallpox, which English slave owners and explorers brought with them. They stayed with neighboring Wampanoags. In the spring of 1621, Squanto and Samoset were hunting near Patuxent and saw pilgrims in the deserted village. They watched the colonists for several days before they approached them and offered to teach them New World survival skills. On March 22, 1621, there was a peace treaty between the English pilgrim leaders and the Wampanoag Confederacy. The leader of the Wampanoag Confederacy was Massasoit. When news spread in England about the New World paradise, more pilgrims and other Europeans immigrated to the New World. The Europeans considered the land as public domain because there were no fences. The pilgrims and other Europeans disregarded Native Americans as the indigenous people of the land. The European pilgrims believed the natives were savages, even though the pilgrims learned from Squanto how to cultivate corn, vegetables, so they would not have any more food shortages. Squanto showed them how to build Indian-style houses instead of living in the dirt-covered shelters the pilgrims were living in. Despite all of this, the Europeans still believed they were savages. The Indians supplied the majority of the pilgrims' food. Contrary to the fabricated lore of storyteller generations, no pilgrims prayed at the meal. What's more, they consumed a good deal of home brew. In fact, each pilgrim drank at least a half gallon of a beer a day, which they preferred even to water. This daily inebriation led their governor, William Bradford, to comment on his people's notorious sin, which included their drunkenness and uncleanliness and rampant sodomy. Later, as the European pilgrims grew in number, they started showing intolerance to the Indians and their religion. The relationship deteriorated between the Pilgrims and the Indians. Any Indian who came within the vicinity of the Pilgrim settlement was subject to robbery, enslavement, or even murder. The Pilgrims further advertised their evil intentions when they mounted 5 cannons on a hill around their settlement, constructed a platform for artillery, and then organized their soldiers into 4 companies, all in preparation for the military destruction of the Native American Indians in their own land. In 1637, over 700 Pequot men, women, infants, and children gathered for their Green Corn Festival, which is America's Thanksgiving celebration today. In the pre-dawn morning, the sleeping Indians in their villages were surrounded by Dutch and English mercenaries who ordered them to come outside of their villages. Those who obeyed were shot, clubbed to death. Women and infants and children huddled inside the long village houses, burned alive, were hung upside down, tortured, infants beaten and killed, slammed against walls, and hung by their ankles. The next day, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony declared a day of Thanksgiving because 700 unarmed men, women, infants, and children were murdered. The wicked and brave European Pilgrim colonists attacked village after village. Women and children over 14 years of age were sold into slavery while the rest were murdered. Boats loaded with as many as 500 Native Indian slaves regularly left the ports of New England, Massachusetts, sending slaves abroad. Bounties were paid for Indian scalps to encourage as many deaths as possible. Following an especially successful raid against the Pequot in now Stamford, Connecticut, the churches announced a second day of Thanksgiving to celebrate victory over the heathen savages. During the feasting, the hacked-off heads of natives were kicked through the streets like soccer balls. Even the friendly Wampanoag did not escape the madness. Their chief was beheaded and his head impaled on a pole in Plymouth, Massachusetts, where it remained on display for 24 years. The killings became more and more frenzied, with the days of Thanksgiving feasts being held after each successful massacre. George Washington finally suggested that only one day of Thanksgiving per year be set aside instead of celebrating each and every massacre. Later, Abraham Lincoln decreed Thanksgiving Day to be a legal national holiday during the Civil War. On the same day, he ordered troops to march against the starving Sioux in Minnesota.
Thank you. Most of us associate the holiday with happy pilgrims and Indians sitting down to a big feast. And that did happen. Once. The story began in 1614 when a band of English explorers sailed home to England with a ship full of Patuxent Indians bound for slavery. They left behind smallpox, which virtually wiped out those who escaped. By the time the pilgrims arrived in Massachusetts Bay, they found only one living Patuxent Indian, a man named Squanto, who had survived slavery in England and knew their language. He taught them to grow corn and to fish, and negotiated a peace treaty between the pilgrims and the Wampanoag Nation. At the end of the first year, the pilgrims held a great feast honoring Squanto and the Wampanoags. But as the word spread in England about the paradise to be found in the New World, religious zealots called the Puritans began arriving by the boatload. Finding no fences around the land, they considered it to be public domain. Joined by other British settlers, they seized land, capturing strong young natives for slaves and killing the rest. But the Pequot Nation had not agreed to the peace treaty Squanto had negotiated, and they fought back. The Pequot War was one of the bloodiest Indian wars ever fought. In 1637, near present day, Groton, Connecticut, over 700 men, women, and children of the Pequot tribe had gathered for their annual Green Corn Festival, which is our Thanksgiving celebration. In the pre-dawn hours, the sleeping Indians were surrounded by the English and Dutch mercenaries, who ordered them to come outside. Those who came out were shot or clubbed to death, while terrified women and children who huddled inside the longhouse were burned alive. The next day, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony declared a day of Thanksgiving because 700 unarmed men, women, and children had been murdered. Cheered by their victory, the brave colonists and their Indian allies attacked village after village. Women and children over 14 were sold into slavery, while the rest were murdered. Boats loaded with as many as 500 slaves regularly left the ports of New England. Bounties were paid for Indian scalps to encourage as many deaths as possible. Following an especially successful raid against the Pequot in what is now Stamford, Connecticut, the churches announced a second day of Thanksgiving to celebrate a victory over the heathen savages. During the feasting, the hacked-off heads of the natives were kicked through the streets like soccer balls. Even the friendly Wampanoag did not escape the madness. Their chief was beheaded and his head impaled on a pole in Plymouth, Massachusetts, where it remained on display for 24 years. The killings became more and more frenzied, with days of Thanksgiving feasts being held after each successful massacre. George Washington finally suggested that only one day of Thanksgiving per year be set aside of celebrating each and every massacre. Later, Abraham Lincoln decreed Thanksgiving Day to be a national legal holiday during the Civil War. On the same day, he ordered troops to march against the starving Sioux in Minnesota. The story doesn't have quite the same fuzzy feeling associated with it as the one where the Indians and pilgrims are all sitting down together at a big feast. But we need to learn our true history so it won't ever be repeated. This Thanksgiving, when you gather with your loved ones to thank your Creator for all your blessings, think about the people who only wanted to live their lives and raise their families. They also took time out to say thank you for all their blessings.
When you think about Thanksgiving, what comes to mind? Indians, pilgrims, turkey, cranberry sauce, etc., etc. Why do we as Americans celebrate this most official national holiday? What do the Native Americans think about Thanksgiving? Did the pilgrims and the Indians celebrate together? And if so, why was there a genocide of 10 to 30 million Native Americans by the hands of the colonists and Puritans? Why are we not taught about the colonists' genocide of the Native Americans in our schools? Is it because Thanksgiving won't look so appealing? Or is it that we are trying to hide the atrocious crimes that the forefathers committed against the Native American tribes? Why don't they tell us that after the Indians taught the colonists everything they knew about surviving in America, the colonists turned around and massacred millions and millions of Indian men, women, and children? This is the version of the Thanksgiving story that was handed down and that is being taught in schools, brainwashing our youth.
The American tradition. After some exploring, the pilgrims chose the land around Plymouth Harbor for their settlement. Unfortunately, they had arrived in December and were not prepared for the New England winter. However, they were aided by friendly Indians who gave them food and showed them how to grow corn. When warm weather came, the colonists planted, fished, hunted, and prepared themselves for the next winter. After harvesting their first crop, they and their Indian friends celebrated the first Thanksgiving.
This is the typical story, but what it does not tell you ruins the perceived meaning of the national holiday. The colonists, along with the Puritans, almost wiped out the Native American populace. The colonists did not like the Indians. They saw the Native Americans as uncivilized and satanic heathens. These same colonists that left England for freedom and religious rights are the same ones that used pestilence, disease, fire, and superior weapons to kill and suppress the natives so that they could steal their land. Below, James W. Lowen speaks on Thanksgiving and one of the lethal weapons that helped kill the native tribes.
James W. Lowen, lies my teacher told me. Many college students are unaware of the horrific plague that devastated and significantly reduced the population of natives after Columbus' arrival in the New World. Most diseases came from animals that were domesticated by Europeans. Cowpox from cows led to smallpox, which was later spread through gifts of blankets by infected Europeans. John Winthrop, the governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, said that the plague was miraculous. Winthrop's letter to a friend in England in 1634 stated, "But for the natives in these parts, God hath so pursued them, as for 3,000 miles space, the greatest part of them are swept away by the smallpox, which still continues among them. So as God hath thereby cleared our title to this place, those who remain in these parts, being in all not 50, have put themselves under our protect." Later, John Winthrop states, "A day of Thanksgiving, thanking God that they had killed 700 plus men, women, and children. It was signed into law that this day forth shall be a day of celebration and thanksgiving for subduing the Pequots." Is this what we're celebrating? The deaths of over 700 men, women, and children? Is that something to be thankful for? William Bradford, governor of Plymouth, talks about another weapon that killed Native Americans. Those that escaped the fire were slain with a sword. Some hewed to pieces, others run through with their rapiers, so that they were quickly dispatched and very few escaped. It was conceived they thus destroyed about 400 at this time. It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire. Horrible was the stink and scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave the prayers thereof to God who had wrought so wonderfully for them. Professor James W. Lowen states, "Thanksgiving is full of embarrassing facts. The pilgrims did not introduce the Native Americans to the tradition. Eastern Indians had observed autumnal harvest celebrations for centuries. Our modern celebrations date back only to 1863. Not until the 1890s did the Pilgrims get included in the tradition. No one even called them Pilgrims until the 1870s.
Many Native Americans do not celebrate Thanksgiving. What they celebrate is a national day of mourning and the remembrance of the Native Americans' demise in colonial times. Thanksgiving is a day of backstabbing and genocide, covered with a layer of patriotism and fabricated truth. It is all woven together with big family dinners and family gatherings. We stand with the Native Americans in recognizing that day as a national day of mourning for a people that was brutally murdered and kicked off their land. We truly feel the Native Americans because they were murdered and thrown off their land, and we as African Americans were taken from our land to be enslaved and murdered. Even though it is hardly ever spoken on, but both Native Americans and African Americans have been through genocide by the hands of the European settlers. By the blood of the Native Americans, this land was acquired, and by the blood of the African Americans, slaves, this country was built. The true meaning of the feast, turkey, yummy roasted turkey. If we only knew the true tradition behind this poultry, we would hesitate to run out and buy one on whatever date Thanksgiving falls on. The turkey represents the 77 million Indians that were murdered for their land. It depicts the decapitation on Indian men. The colonists would kick their heads around for sport and gallivant around the town with beheaded Indian soldiers. It was reported that they kept an Indian chief's head impaled on a staff in their courtyard for about 29 years. Now, this genocide of a people is absolutely wrong, and we should mourn with our Indian brothers, for they withstood a grave injustice at the hands of the earliest settlers and colonists.
What is Thanksgiving without the stuffing? Boy, oh boy, are you in for a disgusting treat. The stuffing we stuff inside of the turkey with all those scrumptious ingredients, well, the tradition behind that is even more gruesome than you can imagine. The stuffing represents the millions of innocent Indian children that were ripped out of their mother's wombs. They were cut out and newborns were thrown against walls, clubbed to death, hung, and at times smashed apart. This is a very unnerving and unsettling to digest. If we all would pay attention, wake up, and realize some of the traditions that are being celebrated and why they are honoring these days, there would be a much different participation rate.
Cranberry sauce. It has to be chilled, of course. The Thanksgiving dinner is not complete without the cranberry sauce. That's what they say. Would you want to eat a sauce that is considered the bloodshed of a people? I just want to know because for years we have been groomed to have the essentials for the holidays. It is all just one thick farce. The berries with their deep reddish burgundy color and the glaze of the sauce. Yes, that represents the 700 Pequot Indians that lost their lives in the early 1620s on November 24th.
The Thanksgiving holiday, with the turkey and stuffing and mashed potatoes and gravy, sweet potatoes, cranberry sauce and corn, and leave some room for pumpkin pie and cherry pie and pecan pie, from grandma and grandpa to the youngest of kids, and good friends who come to share the feast in the spirit of friendship and good cheer. Who doesn't love Thanksgiving? Many of us learned in elementary school about the very first Thanksgiving in 1621. The Pilgrims, who landed a year earlier at Plymouth Rock in what is now Massachusetts, came to America to exercise their religious freedom.
They threw a big feast to celebrate their first year in the new year, and they invited over their new neighbors, the friendly Indians, including the handsome Squanto, who taught them how to grow corn. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty. Also, about the time we were in elementary school, we learned about other special holidays, like when the Easter Bunny brings all children baskets of brightly colored eggs, or when Santa Claus flies all the way from the North Pole in a sled pulled by reindeer to bring presents to every child in the world, all on one night. As we grow into adulthood, we learn that many of the stories we heard as children are more complex than we originally were told. But what about Thanksgiving, the one day of the year when you can totally ignore your diet or how fat you might be? It's the one day where without guilt you can totally chow down until your stomach bloats and your seams burst. And yet it is a day that many American Indians have called a national day of mourning. As adults, we learned that those European invaders stole the land, murdered the friendly Indians who showed them how to plant the sacred corn, and spread diseases that killed many more Indians than the bullets. We learned that they already had their religious freedom in Holland before coming to Plymouth Colony, which primarily was a commercial venture to harvest the riches of the New World by European merchants. Reportedly, the Pilgrims did not even land on the rock that today is known as Plymouth Rock, which first appeared in written accounts 120 years after the original landing. So, what is the truth about Thanksgiving? The truth about the original Thanksgiving is that only one written document exists from that period that mentions, in a single paragraph, the feast that we learned about as kids. And we learned it was not even called Thanksgiving until much later. The Pilgrim Hall Museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts, reports that of the original 102 passengers who set sail in 1620 aboard the 100-foot-long cargo ship Mayflower, only 53 were still alive the following year to attend the 1621 feast. In 1622, a year following the feast, one of the surviving colonists, Edward Winslow, wrote the following in a document now known as Mort's Relation, or more correctly titled, A Relation or Journal of the Beginning and Proceedings of the English Plantations Settled in Plymouth, in New England, by certain English adventurers, both merchants and others. Here's what he wrote. Pretend I have a British accent. You shall understand that in this little time that a few of us have been here, we've built 7 dwelling houses and 4 for the use of the plantation, and have made preparation for diverse others. We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas. And according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase in Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good. But our peas, not worth the gather, for we feared they were too late sown. They came up very well and blossomed, but the sun parched them in the blossom. Our harvest being gotten, our governor sent 4 men on fowling, that so we might after a special manner rejoice together after we had gathered the fruits of our labors. They 4 in one day killed as much fowl as with a little help beside served the company almost a week. At which time, amongst other recreations, we exercised our arms, many of the Indians coming amongst us. And amongst the rest, their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted. And they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation and bestowed on our governor and upon the captain and others. And although it be not always so plentiful as it was at this time with us, yet by the goodness of God, we are so far from want that we often wish you partakers of our plenty. We have found the Indians very faithful in their covenant of peace with us, very loving and ready to pleasure us. We often go to them, and they yielded willingly to be under the protection and subjects to our sovereign Lord King James, so that there is now great peace amongst the Indians themselves, which was not formerly, neither would have been but for us. and we for our parts walk as peaceably and safely in the wood as in the highways in England. We entertain them familiarly in our houses, and they as friendly, bestowing their venison on us. They are a people without any religion or knowledge of any God, yet very trusty, quick of apprehension, ripe-witted, just. The men and women go naked, only a skin about their middles. So what is the truth about Thanksgiving? The truth is that all we really know about what happened at that feast in the autumn of 1621 at Plymouth Plantation is contained in that short passage from the journal. One other written account by the pilgrim William Bradford describes details of the harvest that autumn, but does not mention the feast. Everything else we have seen or heard describing the original Thanksgiving, whether from the school textbooks written by the dominant culture, from paintings, from movies and TV shows, or from the words of Native American activists and historians, are all just speculations, opinions, and conjectures. Even the most widely seen Native American account of the first Plymouth Harvest Feast, from the Public Broadcasting Service series American Experience, titled We Shall Remain After the Mayflower, was full of dialogue, costumes, makeup, locations, and images that were created by writers and filmmakers based on speculations and guesses about what it had been like. So to try to get at the truth, let's look more closely at Mort's relation and that original letter by William Winslow that described the Pilgrim's Feast. That journal chronicles the Pilgrim's first year from leaving Europe on the Mayflower to arriving in Cape Cod Harbor, and then exploring for a suitable place to build their colony. It describes their first encounters with the local Wampanoag Indians, the building of houses and common structures, and establishing firm trading relationships with the various Wampanoag villages throughout the following year. It also contains a letter sent back home to England describing their positive experiences and a final chapter trying to justify their taking of Indian lands through biblical scripture and British common sense. Using that document as a basis, along with other published reports, here is a speculative view of the truth about Thanksgiving. A couple of years before the Pilgrims arrived in Cape Cod Harbor, the Wampanoag tribe lost over half their people from diseases brought in by earlier European invaders. So when the Pilgrims arrived and started making excursions into the land around what is now called Plymouth, they encountered many vacant native lodges and unattended cornfields. The Wampanoag in neighboring villages were very wary of catching more diseases. Pawtuxet, the Indian village that was where the Pilgrims established Plymouth, had been completely wiped out except for one man, Tisquantum, also known as Squanto, who had escaped the disease when 7 years earlier he had been captured by a British sea captain and sold into slavery in Spain. By the intercession of friars, Squanto was released and made his way to England, where he learned English as the servant to a merchant. He returned to his homeland, and because of his English skills, he became an interpreter, one of the voices of the British, to the other Indians. Walt Disney Pictures made a film in 1994 called Squanto, A Warrior's Tale, starring Adam Beach, Eric Schweig, and Irene Bedard, and a tale it is, because it contains many fabrications and historical inaccuracies, including its depiction of the Pilgrim Feast. From Plymouth records, only 53 pilgrims attended the feast. Winslow stated that about 90 Indians, led by Osamekan, known as Massasoit, attended the feast. This means that about twice as many Indians as pilgrims were at that feast, which is something that is usually not shown in movies or paintings of the first Thanksgiving. Today, we celebrate Thanksgiving on the fourth Thursday in November, a date set during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration in 1941. But the Plymouth Feast was probably held in late September or October of 1621. Massasoit's home village was what today is called Warren, Rhode Island, which is south of Providence and about 40 miles west of the Plymouth colony. The pilgrim Edward Winslow did not say they invited Massasoit over for dinner. He just happened by, 40 miles away from home with 90 people. Winslow also said their governor sent four men out to get birds and they brought back four fowl. Plus, it also said for recreation they were exercising their arms, which means they were shooting off their firearms a lot. All this lends credence to the Wampanoag oral history that Massasoit was called to come and see what all the shooting was about and brought a display of force so the pilgrims could see who was in the majority. So the pilgrims probably did what most people would do in that circumstance, which is invite the Indians in for dinner. They stayed for 3 days. Massasoit sent his hunters out and they brought in five deer. So it was basically a potluck dinner that lasted 3 days. Think of it as a colonial version of Facebook, where everybody hung out, got to know each other, and played Farmville with real farms. When the pilgrims first arrived in 1620, they made expeditions into the countryside. One of their first acts on land was to steal a large cache of Indian corn and a metal kettle with the stated intention to reimburse the Indians later, which they did. They also dug into graves and opened up the burial bundles to examine the skulls. Both were hostile acts that illustrate the European attitude towards the indigenous population. The pilgrims did try to establish peace with the Indians. Of course, they did not have much of a choice. Many Europeans had preceded them to the New World, but the numbers were just not there yet. The pilgrims were outnumbered and easily could have been slaughtered by the Indians, despite the pilgrims' far superior technology and weaponry. Unlike today, the various Indian tribes did not see themselves as one homogeneous race. Massasoit's tribe, the Wampanoags, were in a bloody feud with the Narragansett to the north. In fact, the pilgrims came to their aid against the Narragansett. 2 years after the big feast, Massasoit got deathly ill, and Edward Winslow traveled the 40 miles to Massasoit's village with medicine to help nurse the great sachem back to health, for which Massasoit was eternally grateful and pledged his lifelong support to the pilgrims. The British gave the Indians many of the products of their culture, such as cookware, glass beads, fabrics, buckets, foods, tools, weapons, and alcohol. The British were especially happy to get beaver pelts in return, which they shipped back to England as part of their payment to the financiers of the colony. In several places in Mort's Relation, the pilgrims expressed their desire to show Christian love and peace to their neighbors. The pilgrims nonetheless considered the Wampanoag people to be inferior savages and used that word repeatedly. At one point, they described a song and dance the Indians performed for them to be antics, like would be done by buffoons. In the year following the feast, Squanto was accused of using his position with the British to spread fear among the Indians, extract payment for his own self-interest, and usurp the authority of Massasoit. Massasoit called for his death. But Squanto died in that year of what the pilgrims called Indian fever, but was probably from a European-born disease. Peace was maintained between Plymouth and the Wampanoag for about 40 years, until William Bradford and Massasoit passed away, and the power shifted to the second generation of Edward Winslow's son and Massasoit's oldest son, Wamsutta. In the meantime, many thousands of Europeans had arrived, all looking for land. Wamsutta died under mysterious circumstances after being arrested under Winslow's command. Massasoit's younger son, Metacom, also known as King Philip, became the great sachem. By 1675, 54 years after the joyous Thanksgiving feast, the number of British colonists had expanded to about 80,000 people, compared to about roughly 10,500 Indians spread across several feuding tribes. Hostilities and European land grabs had escalated to the point that the Indians had had enough. Metacom led Indian warriors against the colonists in a year-long war known as King Philip's War. Half of the 84 British villages in New England were attacked by war parties. The Indians' goal was to force all the Europeans out. The Europeans' goal was to exterminate all the Indians. The Europeans' advanced technology and weaponry and superior numbers led to a bloody defeat of the Indian forces. Almost a third of the Indians living in the area died, compared to about 800 colonists. The war ended when Metacom was shot dead by another Indian from a tribe that was fighting for the British. The colonists, using the 400-year-old British penalty for high treason against the king, beheaded Metacom, drew his body on a horse-drawn sled, and then cut his body into quarters. His bloody head was impaled on a pole and displayed in the Plymouth town square for the next 10 years. As a result of the defeat, the Wampanoag, Narragansett, Pequot, and other tribes lost their traditional lands. It should be noted that many other important stories exist about the beginnings of Thanksgiving. Native Americans have thanked their creator and blessed the harvesting of their food for centuries before the Europeans arrived. A settlement in the colony of Virginia celebrated an official day of Thanksgiving dating from 1619, 3 years before the Pilgrim's Feast. The Spanish in St. Augustine, Florida, are reported to have held a Thanksgiving celebration in 1585, 36 years before the Pilgrim's Feast. Many European countries have held harvest festivals for hundreds of years before the migrations to the New World. And it's been argued that the Pilgrims had observed a Dutch Thanksgiving festival in the city of Leiden, where they lived before the Mayflower voyage. AIM, the American Indian Movement, reports the research of William B. Newell, a Penobscot tribal member and former chairman of the University of Connecticut Department of Anthropology. His research concluded that the Thanksgiving holiday resulted from the actions of the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, who ordered his militia to attack a gathering in Connecticut of the Pequot tribe for their annual green corn dance, killing 700 people. The next day, the governor ordered a day of Thanksgiving, thanking God that they had eliminated over 700 men, women, and children. According to Newell's research, the annual celebrations of Thanksgiving that followed commemorated that slaughter. It also should be noted that Canada celebrates Thanksgiving on the second Monday of October, dating from early harvest festivals in New France, and celebrating the safe return of the explorer Martin Frobisher from a search for the Northwest Passage in 1578. So, what about today? We must remember that the spirit of the Pilgrims is still alive and well in America. The Euro-Americans here today are the great-great-great-great-grandchildren of those who invaded and created genocide on the native population. The apple does not fall far from the tree. Remember, it was President George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, who has been accused of grave robbing the bones and skull of Geronimo. No one is more savage than a Euro-American who murders men, women, and children just because they are Indians or just because they are Iraqi. However, since the very earliest European invaders, some have murdered, stolen, and raped, but many Euro-Americans have been understanding, giving, loving, nurturing, and admiring of native peoples. And it is equally important in this modern age to keep a realistic view of the past. Many people paint a picture of pre-Columbian America as a utopian world full of happy native people all living in total harmony with the environment. But one need to go no further than New England to find examples of extremely brutal tortures between warring native tribes, such as, for example, the reported practice of binding a captive enemy warrior and then slowly pushing him feet first into the longhouse fire until he was dead. We must remember that savagery is a human characteristic. It is not exclusive to any race, creed, or gender. So, what is the truth about Thanksgiving? The truth is that we should be thankful for the blessings of our harvests. The truth is we should be ever vigilant towards recognizing, understanding, and stopping others who want to exploit us or steal from us. And we should never forget the past. And we should make others aware of the horrors of the past. But in the meantime, why not just sit down, eat some turkey and stuffing, and have some good times with friends and family? Be thankful for the good food and all the blessings we do have in these trying times. Could you please pass the mashed potatoes? Thanks. Save some room for pie. But never forget the truth about Thanksgiving.
One reason we love the story of the Pilgrims is because it's got a terrific ending, the first Thanksgiving. But the way we imagine that historic feast and what really happened are as different as Miles Standish and Miley Cyrus. Take the menu. Did you know that one of the main dishes on the Pilgrims' table was eel? The truth is that the whole story leading up to the first Thanksgiving is stuffed with fictional cranberries.
Let's start with Squanto, the Wampanoag Indian who saves the struggling pilgrims by teaching them how to plant corn. All that's true, but our image of Squanto himself is all wrong. We remember Squanto as a curious example of an uneducated local showing the ropes to the worldly and learned pioneers. The truth is that Squanto has been to England and was better traveled than virtually all of the pilgrims. He had been abducted several years earlier by European explorers.
We had Dutch, French, English traders coming over here, and they were taking native people as slaves.
They stole 27 Wampanoag men, one of whom was Tisquantum, more popularly known as Squanto. He's taken into Spain, but somehow made his way into England, and he managed to come back to New England in 1619.
It's odd that Squanto's globetrotting is mostly missing in action from popular accounts about the pilgrims, since that's how he learned to speak fluent English in the first place, making him uniquely suited to download everything he knows about corn cultivation to the pilgrims.
They would have planted it the same way you plant wheat. And Squanto came to show them the proper way to grow maize is in hills. That's very different than wheat.
And what about the pilgrims' signature contribution that we love them for the most, the first Thanksgiving?
The event happened somewhere between early September and early November 1621. We know from a letter that there was a celebration.
That letter, written by pilgrim Edward Winslow, is the one and only eyewitness account of the event. It's the key to untangling all the facts from the fictions. So, in his account, he must highlight turkey as the main course, right? Even though turkeys are indigenous to the region, the Winslow letter never mentions them. It only describes four hunters being sent out to bag some water birds for the feast, and turkey are land fowl. They can barely swim. What about that cherished gesture of generosity? The pilgrims inviting a few of the Indians to pull up a chair. That never happened. The Wampanoag simply show up in huge numbers, outnumbering the pilgrims almost 2-1.
A lot of the paintings and the pictures on Thanksgiving, the colonists outnumbered the native people by a large amount. We know there was probably over 90 native people at that feast. We know there was about 50 colonists.
And the pilgrims don't so much feed the Wampanoag as the Wampanoag feed the pilgrims. Their chief, Massasoit, sends his tribesmen on a hunt, and they provide enough food for everyone.
They bring back 5 bucks of venison, and venison is so esteemed by English people. To receive a gift of venison is extraordinary to them.
And venison was the meat on the table that everybody went oohed and aahed over and said, oh yes, this is living.
Deer meat, not turkey, is the signature dish on the table. But one thing we can all agree on, this was definitively the first Thanksgiving, establishing an American tradition we've been observing ever since. Sorry, but that's baloney. The truth is that the pilgrims never would have called their harvest feast a Thanksgiving, which for them is a solemn day of prayer spent in church. As the years pass, the influence of the Puritans wanes, and nobody spends all day in church anymore. But the tradition of the harvest feast lives on in New England, and at some point, the name Thanksgiving got attached to it. Which is pretty ironic, because the Puritan Thanksgiving focused on fasting, while the New England Thanksgiving is all about feasting. When Edward Winslow's letter is discovered in 1841, the New Englander who finds it decides the Pilgrim's Harvest Feast ought to be called the First Thanksgiving. It's not until 1864 that it even becomes a national holiday. But once we fall in love with a myth, the real story usually hasn't got a chance, even if it's better than the legend. So chew on that the next time you're chowing down at the Thanksgiving table.
Cause we the people are still here in the rear, yo, we don't need you. You ain't a killing off good young nigga move. When we get hungry, we eat the same fucking food. The ramen noodle. Your simple voodoo is so maniacal, reliable to pull a juju. The irony is that this bad bitch in my lap, she don't tell me she make money, she don't study that. She gon' give it to me, ain't gon' tell me none of that. She gon' take the brain away the plane she sit on that. The doors are signed with it. Don't try to rhyme with it. VH1 has a show that you can waste your time with. Guilty pleasure takes the edge off reality. And for a salary, I'll probably do that just sporadically. The OG Gucci boots are smitten with iguanas. The IRS piranhas see a nigga getting common. Niggas in the hood living in a fishbowl. Gentrify here, now it's not a shithole. Trendsetter, I know my shit's cold. Hand set of it because I ain't so bold. But yeah, all you black folks, you must go. Boy, we hate your ways. All you bad folks, you must go.
The fog and the smog of the media, the lost false narratives of gods that came up against the odds. We're not just nigga rappers with the bars. It's kismet that we're cosmic with the stars. You bastards overlooking street art, better yet street smart, but you keep us off the charts. The fuck your numbers and your statistics. Fuck y'all know about true competition. It's like the AO picture on there talking about a hitting. Yeah. The only one who's hitting are the ones that's currently spitting. We got Jamissi smitten, rubbing on a little kitten, dreaming of a world that's equal for women with no division. Boy, I tell you that's vision. Like Tony Romo when he hitting with him. The tribe be the best in a division. Shaheed Muhammad cut it with precision. Who can come back years later, still hit the shot? Still I'm trying to move you off the fucking block. Babylon, blood clot. Chew on your head, Todd.
All you black folks, you must go. All you Mexicans, you must go. All you bad folks, you must go.